Now comes the hard part for me. But before I get to that, I want to talk about a book, which is back there. It's called Uncommon Friends. This book will be of interest to those of you that like AA history. And I just ran across it myself, so I brought four copies down. If you go into the trivia of AA, there's a name, James Newton, that with some people rings a bell. And James Newton was the link that brought Oxford to Akron so that Dr. Bob and Anne and Henrietta Seiberling were in the Oxford movement for Bill to contact when he came out there. And Newton was a real estate developer in Fort Myer and developed right across from Thomas Edison's home and where he worked and all that. And he became fast friends with Thomas Edison. And Thomas Edison was close friends with Harvey Firestone. And Harvey Firestone came to visit him and said, "I'm looking for somebody to be my right-hand man." And Edison said, "Jim Newton is your guy. Take him out there." So he went from being, now when he's the right-hand man, he is the confidant. And he went from being the confidant of Thomas Edison to the confidant of Harvey Firestone. So much so, Firestone considered giving him the whole business over his sons. That's how, this guy is amazing. He was already a member of the Oxford movement in the United States. And when he got to Akron, he soon saw that Harvey Firestone's son, Bud, was a raging alcoholic and had his father quite concerned. And so when he was going off on a business trip that happened to be near one of the big Oxford events, they would put on these big weekends with celebrities and all of that, and he suggested that Bud go with him. He went, and it took. He just got this spiritual uplift and freedom from drinking. And as time went by, his father said, "How, what happened to you?" "Oh, I was at an Oxford. What is this Oxford?" And when he saw the power of it, he says, "Well, why don't we have it here in Akron?" So Firestone himself called up Buckman and said, "I want a big show here in Akron." And he got Walter Tunks, the minister who said the graveside at Dr. Bob's funeral, his church, I think it was Episcopal, and that they hosted, and it was the front page of the Akron papers, that Oxford is here, and among the people who were attracted by the stuff on the front page was Dr. Bob, not him, but Anne, and she dragged Dr. Bob and the Williams, T. Henry and Clarice Williams, who offered their home for the Oxford meetings, and Henrietta Seiberling. So the stage is now set for Bill to arrive and to go through the phone directory to get the Reverend Tunks and another guy, and then eventually Henrietta Seiberling, and the whole connection was made. So when someone told me that there was a book written by Newton, I wanted to read it because it has a lot about AA and, you know, his view of it all getting started. And he decides that the next person he's going to be the closest confidant to is Rickenbacker, who is a fascinating character in American history. And when I got through reading his view of Rickenbacker, I changed my whole mind about him. He's a much better guy than I thought he was. And then he became fast friends with a doctor named Alex Carroll, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for medicine treating war wounds. And when I say confidants, Lindbergh wanted to, did I say Rickenbacker? Lindbergh. When He wanted to spend time away from everything. He came down to Florida. They went in the Everglades and fished and camped for 2 months at a time. And so there's letters, there's all that. And so it's got a lot of AA history for the trivia guys, and it's a fascinating read. But it's not a spiritual book, but it is. All the people were spiritual. Henry Ford paid his workers the highest rate of any worker in the United States when he opened his assembly line. And he walked the assembly lines. He felt that he owed them part of what he was earning, that they were, he's nobody without them. There was that wonderful thing. And later in his life, his big regret was that it got so big, I don't have anything to spill here. lines got so big that he wasn't down there. And then the unions came and they made the people feel that they didn't like him anymore. And he felt very sad. But anyway, that's it. Okay, we're going to do half the questions roughly and take a break in about 40 minutes. I'm just going to read them and give you my best shot. Now, when someone answers a question, it does not mean it's the true answer to the question. There is no one answer to any question. It means this is what it looks like to me today. That's all it means. When I look at this, this is what I see. And 2 years from now, I could give you a different answer. And I've learned as the years have gone by that that truth comes in a very strange fashion. What happens is there's a truth for you and I, and then later on there's something more true. But it doesn't cancel out the fact that the other one was also true at the time. So there's truth and then more truth and then more truth, including, it's an inclusive. And the example that someone gave was that the Newton's laws of motion don't apply everywhere in the universe. There are certain places where, due to the uniqueness, they don't hold true there, but they're still true. In other words, they still are valid, but there's places where they aren't. It doesn't wipe them out. It's just that's the nature of things. What types of meditation works for you? Well, I think I covered that mine is the very short amount many times a day. That's meditation. Then reflection, I do it all the time. When I'm reading, if I see a sentence that really grabs me, I write it down or something like it, and then I sit and try and see the third dimension of that. I mean, you could take something like it works, it really does, and stay with it and just go, now that I've been sober 15 years, what do I see when I look at that simple sentence, it works, it really does? And you'll see how it may make you feel so comfortable that here is a little tiny, absolutely true statement that is so warm to think about. You know, it really does, because now you've seen 1,000 people come after you. And you know when you say it works, it really does, it does. And so it's just that's my experience with that. What is a spiritual awakening? Having had a spiritual awakening, what is the place for having a sponsor? Okay, I mean, we have definitions in our literature. And a good one is in the 12 and 12, what we could not see, do, or feel before, unaided, a profound personality change, a psychic change. There's many of these. And I liked the discussion we had earlier when I posed the question, if awakening is the answer, what's the problem that it's solving? That really leads to some pretty deep thinking. What was I before I awakened? What is that? And it leads to the inescapable realization that a lot of what you see and think ain't. And I ended up calling it a self-centered trance rather than saying we're all in a dream state, in a dream world, and we're going to awaken out of it. It is so far-reaching that it's frightening almost. You mean I've been wrong about everything? You mean actually I live in Russia? You know what I mean? It would be like that. You mean this is Russia here? It would be something like of that magnitude. And the ego is just crushed by the magnitude of what an awakening symbolizes. And this, I think I told you at the very beginning, I now sponsor people by saying my job is to show you how to have an awakening. And naturally, that includes staying sober. The awakening is the power to see that alcohol won't help you at all. That you now live in a place where there's nothing for alcohol to fix. There's an awakening. You go, well, I might have a drink, but I don't need one. That, you know, that sort of a feeling. That's a real awakening. Now, there's many other definitions. I'm just giving you the one that is in my head today. I absolutely did not want to take the first drink. Since I did not want to take the first drink, then who took the first drink? I think we could work this into a who's on first routine. I don't know. No, that's third base. The older people know that one by heart, right? Who's on first? I don't know. No, he's on second. Okay. It's as if there's two of us. There's the part of us that doesn't want to take the drink, and there's part of us that takes the drink in spite of us not wanting to take it. And so the part of us that wants to maintain the self-centered trance wants to take the drink because that creates the separate world in spades. I mean, if you want to create separation, take one drink. The part that wants to take the drink, as we saw in Dr. Natcher's paper, honestly believes that the taking of the drink will solve the separation problem. Remember he talked about all addictions are false roads towards solving the separation, the return home problem. And so even the ego that wants to take the drink thinks it is answering some serious situation that we have in ourselves because in the very beginning it appeared to solve it. It appeared to put us in a world that was comfortable to live in. And the people in the world were no longer threatening. So we really thought we were on the right place. And even when it was collapsing, I think I said in my story, oh, I didn't tell my story. Well, then I can't do that. But I think during the first night of drinking, I saw that drinking would be worth any price. It was that important and wonderful. And then as the years went on, I paid the price. But the decision came early on. So we're separated in ourselves. We're separated from God, from other people, and from ourself. And we want to end that separation and become unified with our true self, which is pure love, pure spirit, etc. We want to come home to our true self. So there we are with the duality of our own existence, one going this way and one knowing knowing at a deep level that that really won't work. Not a bad answer, not the best. Please provide your experience and view on the use reference of literature that is not AA conference approved in AA meetings. Did you write this, Chris? I do have some pet peeves. We got plenty of time, so I will give you... No, I mean, this is not a simple question. The question here is about the circle and triangle. That's what it's about. Because conference approved replaced the circle and the triangle. So it is the disappearance of the circle and the triangle that begins this. And so the question is, how come we had the circle and triangle and adopted it, and it was our symbol for all those years? It was on the big book, the 12 and 12, and all of conference literature. You know, how to get a sponsor, am I an alcoholic, are you an alcoholic? You know, all of those pamphlets, bam, circle and triangle. And then one day, New York came to the General Service Conference, and they said, you know, we have a trademark on circle and triangle, and there's a lot of AA members that love these medallions and necklaces and bracelets with the circle and triangle. And technically, that's a violation of our trademark. So we think in order to have those people enjoy those trinkets, that we ought to voluntarily give it up. And everybody went along with it. And if you read the Grapevine article on the loss of the circle and triangle, that's exactly what it says. That it was a voluntary giving up of the trademark. What's left out is a little background material. It seems that 140 merchants who sold these, you've been to conventions and there'll be a motel room with some, a lot of times it's an AA member. They got the T-shirts and this and that. And they wrote New York, and the staff wrote them back and said, that's fine. So they had permission, but not official permission. And one day the lawyers got in on it. We got a few up there. And they said, we can't have this. This is reducing the effectiveness of our trademark. Tell the merchants to stop. So they wrote, most of them were small, so they ate their inventory and stopped. Two of them were bigger and told New York to take a hike. So legal action was taken, and I think it was a couple $100,000 was spent, and they saw they were going to lose. So then they came and said, we think it would be a good idea to voluntarily give up the trademark. And the Grapevine article mentions nothing of the legal action. It just mentions the altruistic niceness of giving it up. I don't know. I'm just commenting. So now, and the funny thing is, geez, this is amazing that somebody wrote this now. Because I found a way, God, if I tell you guys, I'll run out of my supply. But I'm trying to help my Dick, who runs our prison mission, and he gets big books to people in jail. And I said, well, you know something? I can get them a lot cheaper. I can buy third editions online used for $1, $2, and $2 shipping. I get them shipped to me 40 at a time for $4 each. I give them to him, and he can distribute twice as many books because the new one is $7.60 or something like that. So I'm starting to collect these, and I go through them when they arrive, and I found a first print. which is kind of cool. And then I noticed that most of them have the circle and triangle, and then it stopped. And it stopped, for you trivia people, on the 49th printing. The 49th printing of the third edition. What is it? 43rd? Of the third edition. Yeah, the 49th printing has the circle and triangle. The 50th, the circle and triangle's gone, but there's no conference approved. It's kind of a quirk in our system. It's the only one with neither. And then on the 51st printing, conference approved appears there. So if you go into the official adoption of conference approved, it goes out of its way to say there's no such thing as non-conference approved. This is simply to tell people, this tells you this was written in New York and was written by the General Service Conference or staff and is official. But again, no opinion on other literature. Because, of course, if you go back to the very beginning, they had the Sermon on the Mount and the Bible and the 24-hour days and the man upstairs. Some of you historians can tell me all of the books that were lying around at AA meetings. And so some force. Now, we have people who like to have rules, and so they'll run around and get these books off the table. But my opinion in studying the history is other books being offered at AA meetings will reduce the amount of money going to New York. I'm not saying that's the only reason, but that's a very powerful one. And as the years went on, a guideline came out that didn't go through the General Service Conference. And in that, it says, we recommend that groups don't sell anything but books printed by AA. But that didn't go through the conference. And so, being a radical, I buy Chuck Chamberlain's new pair of glasses, and you can win it, but you can't buy it. I'm probably violating everything, and there's several people in this room who are no longer going to listen to me. But that's my background on it. I'm sure there's a case that could be made. If we put all this crap in here, it'll confuse people, and they won't know what they're doing, and so on down. When I sponsor people, the only stuff I talk about is the big book and the 12 and 12, and AA comes of age, and pass it on, and all of that. And as they get really sober, then I tell them about the best history book that's ever been written, Not God. I mean, that Ernest Kurtz book, it is the ultimate history book on AA. I don't know if it's back there, but I think it's wonderful. Now, I'm sure there's some in here who could tell you a different version, but that's what my research and my looking at this is. And so, also, groups are autonomous. And if a group doesn't want anything in there and doesn't even want anything mentioned, it's their right to do that. And we got to remember that autonomy is autonomy. Boy, that took a long time. I can feel the ill will in the room. Chris knows me. I get going on things. I hope there's no question here about lawsuits. No. You lawyers. I'll I'm just going to make one comment and then I'll shut up. The delegates, many delegates, have tried unsuccessfully to have a consideration at the conference for a vote that no legal actions be taken that aren't run by the delegates, and they can't even get it up for discussion. That's the end of this comment. How do we address spirituality in the workplace? I think clearly the workplace is divided into goals and time and all the things that we were talking we have to get rid of if we want to spiritually be in the now. So we actually have to be two people. We are a worker in the material world, and as such, if our boss says, I need 10 sales, then you have to bust your butt to get the 10 sales, because that's the nature of the place that you work. But we have to divest ourselves from the results of the 10 sales. We have to understand that the 10 sales will not make us happy, and that our happiness should not be contingent on making those sales. I am going to do my best to be of service to my boss. That's it. In other words, I'm detaching from the results in terms of my own happiness. And that takes a lot of the pressure off. In other words, I'm going to be just as happy without a job as with a job. That's a very nice place to be. I know that God will take care of me and I'll have another job. So I can reduce the pressure I'm putting on myself in the workplace. Guess what that does? It frees us up to receive intuitive guidance on who to call for a sales call, who to do all this. And so we end up doing more work with less effort. We get more access to solutions and guidance with less effort on our part. And as Bill writes in the 12 and 12, we become more efficient. We simply acknowledge the instructions that are needed by our material situation, and we even ask for guidance in that. And so that's how I... Now, the other thing is, I take quick breaks all day long to do 20 seconds of breathing. So I'm bringing spirituality into the workplace, increasing the space that I'm operating in so the pressure of him coming in isn't confined in such a small space that I am panicking and not functioning anywhere near 100% because I'm so nervous about being broke or whatever it is, or having my ego smashed by being yelled at in front of others. Heaven forbid that you would get a butt chewing in front of co-workers, you know, something as horrible as that. And we can become less afraid of something like that. What's that? The co-workers are going, look at the boss, he's a jerk. I used to think they were looking at me going, he's a terrible worker, because they've received the same thing. These are great. Please provide your experience and view on the back end of step 11. Oh my God, these are great. Praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry it out. His knowledge and the power. Well, I think I said that it is remarkable that prayer, it's limited to knowledge of his will and the power to carry it out. Everywhere you pray for the sick person, you pray, we form prayer groups, pray for peace. There's pray, 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 pray. And yet, here we have, and Bill in the 12 and 12 acknowledges how difficult it is to not be tempted to pray for other things. I can't remember the exact wording, but it's in the 12 and 12. And so he says, okay, if you are, you know, maybe you're in a church and they do this type of praying, at the end of it say, if it be thy will. If it be thy will. He knows he's with very fragile egos and self-esteem in AA. And if you pray for something specific and it doesn't happen, how do you explain that to yourself? I'm not worthy of God's help. There is no God. I prayed and my son died. What does that mean? How could God let him die when I'm praying? That he, you see what I'm saying? And we would take that type of situation and turn it into a reason to drink. Turn it into a drunk. We're sitting at the bar. What's the matter? God killed my son. See what I'm saying? We just took it all the way. He hated me so much that he... Now, that's a very immature perspective on prayer. That's our middle name. Immature. That was a great thing that bugged Bill. You know, in the 12 and 12, and it's probably about three-quarters of the way through the discussion on step 12. Now, Kristen, we laugh about this one. This is AA is, let's see, the 12 and 12 is written in 50. And so AA is 15 years old. And so, as Bill said, they went to a group of eminent doctors and psychologists, and they said to them, hey, you remember the low self-esteem, childish little kids we were when we first got sober? And you came and looked at us and said, oh my God, what a mess. How about looking at us now with 11 years? And they did, and they said, you're still childish, immature, and grandiose. And he wrote in there, how we did resent that verdict. Childish, immature, and grandiose. That personality and that vulnerability that we all have would make us very vulnerable to praying for specific things that didn't come true. So part of it could have been that, but part of it could have been just brilliant wisdom. The biggest contribution that a human being can do is to bring someone into contact with their Creator. And all we want is guidance. That's what Chuck Chamberlain said. Last 22 years, I just got up every day and got guided by God. In other words, is there a plan for a better life than to be guided by God every day? What could it be? What could be superior to that? It's the perfect description of becoming a servant. And we often talk about that in AA. We come here a big shot, and if you work real hard, you can become a servant. It is the, this is what the struggle is all about. I created my own kingdom. It's terrible in there, but I'm the boss. I call all the shots. They're all miserable, and I hate it in there, and it's lonely, and I'm frightened, but I'm in charge. Okay, choice number two. Come on into God's kingdom and serve him. Serve? Let's see, servant or in charge of a rotten place? I'll take the rotten place. I'll take a compromise. We just don't want. So this is tremendous humility. I don't know what the right thing to pray for is. I'm so humble, I have no idea what would be the right thing to pray for on this planet. That's pretty humble. So I'm simply going to do what God would like me to do. And I know I can't carry it out because, as Bill writes, we had a code of morals, high standards. We just couldn't live up to them. Many of us had wonderful moral philosophies, but on our own, we kept letting ourselves down. And so my humility says, and the power to carry them out. So way or the other, either backwards or forwards, I think we ended up with the ultimate spiritual formula. It's just brilliant. That's the way I see that little part. All right. How do I get centered again when I get angry, fearful, frustrated, etc., and lose conscious contact with God? Well, first we admit it. That's our standard thing. We call up our sponsor or a friend or whoever it is and just say whatever it is. I'm terrified. I read about the stock market. I'm terrified. I can't sleep. Okay, so now it's out and it's on the table so that the universe knows about it. And then I turn to the part of me that is concerned, that is frightened, that is panicky, that is overpowered by it. And instead of being angry at that part of me, I turn to it and say, I don't blame you for being frightened. This is frightening times. So now we didn't alienate that part of us by saying, you stupid wimp, why don't you grow up and be a spiritual being? We acknowledge this as a friendly thing. Yeah, I understand you're panicking. Okay. I'll be back. I'm just going to hang out with God for a while. And literally, I just be in God's presence. I don't ask him to fix this. I don't ask for anything. I just spend more time with God than with that problem. It's a question of time. This is my own realization. Problems need to be watered to stay alive. And if you just give them a drop or two, they think you're paying attention to them. And you can go over and get your nourishment and let them die of neglect, which is having them removed. They never do get solved. I'm not frightened anymore. Why? I don't know. I'm just not frightened. Well, how did you figure it out? I don't think I did. I just think it's just not bothering me anymore. So that's what I call the easy spiritual way. And the key is to acknowledge it, to tell that part of us that's all excited, that little part of us that wants to scream the world's coming to an end, and turn and go, well, I could see why you feel that way, like you would with a little child. Yes, okay, good, yeah, I see why you're frightened. Relax, I'll be back. And then I go where I love being and hang out there. That's one thought. Your sobriety date is December 7th, 1964. What was December 6th, 1964 like? And describe your first day of sobriety. Holy cow. Wow. Well, December 6th was a Saturday, and I was an outpatient from the nut ward where I'd been locked up first in a straitjacket and then eventually free reign of the ward. And had actually gotten quite comfortable in there. You stay there long enough, it becomes a very safe place. You get out of bed and you go over and you all hang out on this side and watch the sunrise. Then you play cards and then later in the day you go over and watch the sun go down. And you don't have to have any visitors unless you want them. But I had been ready to go back to active duty and I could go home at night and weekends. And I started drinking again and I knew they were going to catch me. And Saturday, I knew when I went back Monday because I couldn't stop. I went out to play golf at Quantico and just drove people crazy. I was having hallucinations, and I was just shaking, and I knew I might have another seizure. And Sunday, I couldn't get the drinks to stay down, so I called Intergroup. And they said that they had a guy, was the only other Marine at Quantico, and he was going to come over. And I kept trying to get the drinks down, and I eventually got two down, and I called him back to call it off. I said, I no longer need the help. And they said, he's on his way, too late. And so then he arrived, and so that's all I remember. And he drove me to that meeting, and that was the last drink. It just, there was, when I finished the first meeting, I was in. And so that's my, wow, December 6th, 1964. Oh, there's nothing to open. My first and only sponsor for 14 years passed away a couple of years ago. I've not asked anyone to become my new sponsor. I have a few guys that I talk to, but I always feel like no one could measure up to the first one. How important is it 16 years sober? I think there's two answers, a general answer and an answer in this specific case. I don't have a sponsor. I don't talk about that because it's disconcerting to new people and people that are sponsoring new people. I have three advisors. I just can't think of anybody that could be where Bill was for 42 years. That's how I see it. I have a guy from Washington, D.C. that I knew in early sobriety. He lives near me. We get together when either one of us has something. And it's just absolutely wonderful. I just don't talk about it because I know that it flies in the face of the traditional, yes, boom, chain of sponsorship and all of that. I'm just leveling with you guys where I'm at. And so with 16 years, you really have to look in your heart and make sure you're not kidding yourself and your ego isn't getting in there. So I would have close friends and ask their advice and see if they see any weakness in your decision-making process. I've asked people and they say, no, this is 4 years now. And they say, no, he's, and I'm always asking people, how do I see him? I like people to stick their nose in my business and come up, you all right? And you should give people permission. If they see the look on your face and go, what is it? So that we can't keep secrets from each other. And so that would be the general answer, always have a sponsor. And someone with 16 years, I would say the general answer is a very good one, but you can look at this and talk to people and make sure your reasons for where you are valid and solid. And then I would say, and the big book doesn't mention sponsor. Okay. If it does, show it to me. After completing the ninth step, how do I pursue continuous conscious contact? Well, the conscious contact for most of us occurs in the ninth step. We suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. You can't have a better description of conscious contact. You personally realize it. Oh my God, this is God doing this. That's a pretty good contact. It's almost as if he came knocking on the door. I just want you to see I'm here. And the promises themselves are also magical. Self-seeking will slip away. You will be amazed before you're halfway through. I mean, just look at the language. That's not psychological language. That's spiritual. Gone. Fear of people, economic insecurity will leave us. You know, like, where the hell? What's that? How'd you get rid of it? I didn't get rid of it. It left me. It's spiritual. This is all huge. They sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always, and again, magical word, materialize. Just look at the choice of words there. So some sort of contact is presumed at that state in our sobriety, which leads, as you come into the 10th step, it's the second sentence, we have entered the world of the Spirit. You see that? Boom. Conscious contact, magic, 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 in the world of the Spirit. What does that mean? New world, new rules. Material world, go to work, save money, put money in the bank, have a wife, have a kid, boom, whatever, all that. World of the Spirit. These rules, no, that stuff doesn't apply over here. We got new rules. And here they come. Is it a list this long? No, it's like this. Remember what it says? Here's the new rules in the worlds of the Spirit. If we're frightened, upset, resentful, whatever it is, we ask God at once to remove them. Okay, any questions about the rules of the world of the Spirit? Any questions? Any questions? Okay, so there's the rules of the Spirit. You got it? World of the Spirit, rules of the world of the Spirit. Now let's go to a discussion meeting. Say, what do you all do about resentment? Oh, when I get a resentment, what I try and do is think it through and realize. Well, thank you, Mary. How about you, Joe? Well, here's what I do. I try to see the other guy's side of it. And I try to be understanding. And I try to, well, thank you, Joe. How about you, Larry? Well, what I do is I call my sponsor and we try together to see it differently. No one in the room said, I ask God at once to remove it. Why not? Too simple. Too simple. That couldn't work. You think I'm going to totally rely on God? That's impossible. I mean, can you see the resistance to that simple plan? When we say keep it simple, we ask God at once to remove it. And all the rest from here on is all about God. Maintaining contact, improving contact, 10th step in the 12 and 12, the marvelous formula of how to stay undisturbed. Suddenly, the top goal in the world of the Spirit is staying undisturbed. Remember the axiom? If I'm disturbed, no matter what, there's something wrong with me. And then the four-part plan to stay undisturbed or to get undisturbed if you do get disturbed. 1, 2, 3, 4. Honest self-restraint. You remember that? Self-restraint. Honest analysis of what's wrong. Call up your sponsor. Hey, this happened at work. This can all be done in 45 seconds. And my boss came in and he was unfair and this thing, and I don't care, right in front of everybody. Blah, 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 blah. And the sponsor said, well, the stuff he wrote is all screwed up. Go tell him he's right and that you'll do a better job. Okay. Or your boss is being outrageous. Forgive him. Well, what kind of a plan is that? Bam, we're back to undisturbed. We're back to conscious contact. End of the game. That's the end game, conscious contact. You can't go beyond that. There's no goal beyond it. No goals over here. So that's my thoughts on that. Magic moment in time, going from 9 to 10. Take a break, Chris. Break! And Chris will yell, worked the step several times in my 7 years. My fear is better than it used to be, but still shows its ugly head. Does it ever disappear completely? Does the wreckage of the past ever end? 7 years later, I'm still struggling to get my kids back in my life. Now, I'm not familiar with working the steps several times in my 7 years. When I sponsor someone, we go all the way to spiritual awakening. And then we maintain the spiritual awakening. And fear is removed through awakening. It's similar to when you're little and you thought you saw some kind of a figure in your closet in the bedroom. You remember it was a shadow? And if someone said to you, well, just get rid of the fear, you wouldn't be able to do it because you're convinced that there's something in there. So your mother comes in and puts a light on, and it's not there. So it is, the awakening is to present a non-fearful situation, which it's hard to be afraid of because now the light's on. So this, trying to directly attack the fear is like chasing your shadow. You just can never get it. It's too elusive. And so we acknowledge the fear, pay attention to it. We were talking about this with a couple of you individually. And then turn to hang out with conscious contact. Just go, I hear you. That's a legitimate fear. Good. Well, glad you're there. I'll be back. And so we never stop the voices by shouting at them and controlling them. Ignoring is the antidote for everything. And my kids, when I got divorced in sobriety, all of my kids didn't want to talk to me. It was my fault. And now we're like this, that we were like this. And my ex-wife and I are like this. We're just as close as can be. And it happened in God's time, and it didn't happen because of anything I did. So I don't think there's a secret. I'm still struggling to get my kids back. I would stop struggling. I would surrender the whole issue and just love them with no demand that they come back. And they'll just feel the love without the demand to come back, and they could easily come back on their own. It'll be their idea. Not a perfect answer, but not a bad one. Okay, maybe. Can you speak on the nature of surrender? How I think of it has changed during my recovery. I no longer beg or beseech my higher power to grant me anything. I yield and accept that my higher power denies me nothing and so grants me serenity, courage, and wisdom. When I am surrendered, I am mindful of presence of God within me and acting from loving kindness. What are your thoughts? I think this is incredibly solid. I really agree with this, the way you're describing where you're at. Surrender is a synonym for letting go. And what my attitude about that over the years is, there's nothing else to the program but letting go. You need the faith to take that leap. I mean, you're letting go. That's unbelievable. What'll happen? Where will you be? I mean, it's like jumping into space. And just go, I hope there's something here to catch me, because I've left all my ways of feeling safe in this world. So surrender has come to mean letting go, and you find that God's standing right there. He's just going, I've been waiting for you. We've actually been, you know, this far apart. That was great. Please, Lee asked that in the break. It's an old joke about a woman. And since none of you have ever had any problems in that department, singleness is perfect. Sometimes becomes an issue at group level, especially speaker meetings, real alcoholics versus blah, 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 blah. I'm with Clancy on singleness of purpose. I think if it were explained correctly and in a loving way from sponsor to pigeon, or as they say today, sponsee, that the problem would be greatly relieved. It is very difficult to solve it by getting angry and yelling at someone in front of everyone else. Hey! We don't have to over here. You follow what I'm saying? I'm sure the recipient of that will go, oh, I see your point. I think I'll fully cooperate from this day forward. So, this is what I think it centers on. And Clancy uses this word, identification. So how does AA work? Unlike everywhere else, when you have a problem, you go to a therapist, you go to a doctor, I don't care where you go, they sit you down and they say, tell me about you, except AA. We go over there and we go, sit down. I'm going to tell you about me. That's how it works. I go there, I tell him about me, and then he identifies. Oh my God, another person just like me. That identification is the glue that holds the whole thing together. The realization in his mind that he is talking to someone who knows exactly how he feels. The identification was, the identification issue was so strong when I was new that I felt uncomfortable talking to a periodic drinker. Because I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. I drank every day. I didn't feel qualified to talk to him. What am I going to say? I know how you feel. Oh, yeah. Went 3 months and never thought of drinking. Yeah, I know how you feel. I don't know how he feels. What the hell is that? And we would sometimes go get a periodic to talk to a periodic just to get the identification. So if I go over to someone's house and I say to him, well, when I tried to get the needle in my arm, my hand shook so bad I could barely get it in there. You know, kind of like your hand shakes when you're trying to pour a drink. I don't see the connection. I don't see him saying, ah, yeah. Now, I may have a gambling problem. I may have a drug problem. I may have a sex problem. But I want to connect with this guy on something where we both are going to solidify with glue. So I'm only going to talk to him about alcohol. He may have a gambling problem or whatever, but I know if me and him, to start the glue, will connect on the common problem. Everybody has a myriad of problems, relationship problems, suicide problems, all these things. Look at the paper by Dr. Natcher. All the addictions, they're all out there. All we're saying is, if you bond on just one, the glue will be stronger than if you try and bond on three or four. And I compare it to the tiles on the space shuttle. You remember when three or four of them came off? That would be the four that didn't have primary purpose. If it's explained this way to someone new, they would then get up, and if they're giving a talk, they would say, my story involves all kinds of things. And they could even rattle them off with gambling and suicide and cocaine. But in respect to AA, I'm just going to talk about drinking. And I think everybody would be happy. This person was honest with himself by saying, there's a myriad of things wrong with me, but out of respect to you and our primary purpose, I'm going to limit what I say. A guy came up to me, had been on crack, is that what it is? Crack. And he said, I've been on crack for 2 months. Can you sponsor me? And I said, yeah, if you never say the word crack again. He never said it. We talked about alcohol, and he's got 2 years, and he's wonderful. So that's just my take on primary purpose. One-on-one, explain it. No lecture in front of the group. People don't like lectures. They do not like... I work with and around people who are judgmental and draining. Where is that? I never run into them. Aside from isolation, what does one do spiritually to face this day after day? It often seems prayer isn't enough. Okay, prayer isn't enough, but acceptance is the key to everything, as Dr. Paul said. In other words, instead of praying that the judgmental and draining people go away, pray that they don't bother you. Now see, when you hear that, you go, okay, technically I could see how that might work, but I want them to go away. In other words, we don't really want the spiritual solution. It's the same thing. If judgmental and draining people don't bother you, it doesn't matter that they're judgmental and draining. They just are. And now they're only bothering that guy. And he's talking to his sponsor, and you don't hear it anymore. Do you follow what I'm saying? You want to pray that the transformation take place in you, not in them. It's all about transforming ourselves. Always come back and see what it is in me that could be changed to fix make the problem disappear. If they aren't bothering you, there is no problem left, and they're still judgmental and draining. Okay, here we go. Is there a difference between spiritual awakening and conscious contact? Probably not. The first, for the historians here, first edition, first printing said spiritual experience. Second printing said spiritual awakening. I really like awakening. I'm glad. I don't even remember why they did that. I think they thought that spiritual awakening was less grandiose and religious than spiritual experience. It was probably to appease the New York crowd. Oh, I'm sorry. And Jim Burwell and all those guys. And so... The awakening results in contact. And since it's simultaneous, you could be talking about the same thing. And so I want to maintain the awakened status. You see what I'm saying? I think they're very, very similar. How do we reduce our unsatisfied demands? We ask God to do it. And then you go, well, gee whiz. See, we're getting back to step 6 and 7. We're getting back to that problem that I brought up earlier. We want our demands reduced, but not too far. Okay? I got a lust problem. And I want God's help because I haven't been able to do a thing about it. There I am, back on the porn channel. There I am, over to the strip joint. It's driving me crazy. My wife is upset. I've got to do something about it. Why don't you ask God to take it away? All of it? What would it be to have no lust? is that dead? Would that be dangerous? That sounds too extreme. What I'd like God to do, reduce them. You follow what I'm saying? And so the answer is God does it. We can only make a dent in any character defect that we have. But it's very difficult. And we can make progress. I mean, you can see a little bit. But the underlying struggle is still there. And so it is the willingness. First of all, I like the idea of acknowledging the demand. I hear you. Yeah, you're there. I want to go hang out with God. And then see if that, in fact, slowly doesn't cause it to go away. Please elaborate on the phrase, we have entered the world of the Spirit. Bingo! I think we just talked about that. And then I said what it was. We've entered the world of the Spirit, new rules. New rules. And it's all involved holding God's hand. Chuck said it. Last 22 years, I just got up every day and waited for guidance from God. So I could put that on the blackboard. Get up every day and wait for guidance for God. And then we would sit and we'd look at it and go, yeah, but what do? Can't you feel it? Can't you feel the practical part of you going, yeah, okay, but what do you really do? I got to go to work. I got a family to feed. And then we go, you see, it says sit there and wait for God. And it's very hard to move there. So that's my answer to that. Hey, we're making good progress. Can you do too much AA? I think I probably did in the beginning. Now, maybe it was necessary, but I had 6 kids, and I went to AA every night at 8:30 after working all day, missed a lot of graduations, missed a lot of birthdays, missed a lot of things that a father should be participating in on the grounds that it could affect my sobriety. And I look back on it, and I think I could have possibly made a few birthdays and stayed sober. So I fault myself, and you might call that doing too much AA. Can you do too much God? No. There's a difference. In other words, just because I have to miss a meeting tonight doesn't mean I have to miss hanging out with God. I can hang out with God at the symphony. I can hang out with God at the birthday party. I can sit here and say, thank you, God, for the cake, and look at this. Oh, man, this is wonderful. Oh, yeah. You see, he's included in everything, even though I'm not at the meeting. If it's involved shirking responsibilities in order to hang out with the guys at the meeting, that could be considered too much AA. Will praying only for his will keep me from getting what I want? You know why this question is getting such a rise? We all know it. We all feel that. Okay, why do we want to get what we want? Which is the same as saying, why do we want to get our way? This is my take. What creates the idea of generating a thing called a way? You know, the way I want to turn out. What is the energy that causes us to put together a plan of some sort to get what I want? I would submit to you the energy behind that. You're not happy. You're miserable in your own skin. And you have put together a plan, as you see it, to get rid of this discomfort. Would everybody agree that that may be real reason for putting together something called what I want? What if you were already happy? You wouldn't have to put together much of a plan, would you? You'd just live in the now. I'm already happy. I can't think of anything to have a plan. What am I going to work for? Where is there to go from here? And so whatever you're wanting won't make you happy. And that's what we've all learned. How many times did I say, if I ever had $10,000 in the bank, I would sleep like a baby. I'd have that financial security I was looking. Well, actually, it's 20. Now that I'm here, it's 20,000. Well, with inflation now, it's probably 40. If I had the 40, and people have gotten, they said, well, 2 million. One was close, but 2, 3. I mean, you just keep going, and then you go, okay, if I had a different wife. That's what it is. Remember how your mind goes, have you ever gotten there? Say, there, finally. My plan came true, and I'm through planning. This is it. Never enough, right? We got to keep going, got to keep going. So spirituality is getting rid of all want. That's perfect peace of mind. There's no such thing as want. It's gone. Can you imagine that? You're free from wanting anything. What are you going to do all day? Just hang out with God. Freedom from want is, boy, that's a big one. Material success came quickly for me, and I surrendered and went through the 12 steps. How do I fend off from becoming grandiose? Now you're talking about one of the great problems in spirituality, which is spiritual pride. And it's a killer. And I think I mentioned it yesterday. One of the things about spirituality is it gets results. We go from unhappy and lonely and all of these things into a sense of well-being. And the sense of well-being itself then becomes dangerous because we no longer need God. That's what it feels like. Thank you, God. And we almost make the ego prayer of gratitude. Thank you, God. Thank you. Can you imagine the ego praying? Thank you, God. Thank you, God. Thank you, God, for taking away my fear, for taking away all of those things, for placing me in a position where I'm a good father, placing me in a position where my life has been returned to me. Thank you, thank you, thank you for placing me where I no longer need your sorry ass. Do you see that? Thank you for making me self-sufficient. I like being in charge again, but I am expressing my gratitude to you as I say goodbye. We don't even know we're doing that. That's what grandiosity is. It is slowly taking credit for God's work. And so we have to stay grateful. Was that thunder? To paraphrase Chuck Sees, AAs are highly sensitive idealists whose worldview requires us to believe we need to outthink, outperform, and outmaneuver. That's Chuck. In order to eke out a miserable living out of an unfriendly universe. Is this a special gift of AAs from God, or are normal people like this too? I would think there's plenty of normal people who think they have to outperform and outmaneuver others in order to eke out a miserable living in an unfriendly universe. I would say there's plenty of what we call earth people who are in that same boat. Our problem is that we thought the answer to that was alcohol. And it's hard for us to release that thing we were relying on and go into this unknown thing called God. And that's what Chuck found out was, are we at the end, Lee? 5 minutes. Hey, last question. Now, maybe that wasn't answered to me. What's the difference between belief in God and trusting God? I would say belief in God occurs before conscious contact and trust occurs after. Once you have contact, you don't have to believe in God anymore. You don't have to hope in God. You don't have anything. You got there. So now you trust him. In other words, oh, I hope God reaches out and touches my hand. I hope, I believe he will. I believe. Bingo. I don't have to believe anymore. It's here. Now I have contact, trust, whatever you want to call it. And we're contact is it. That's why from then on we maintain contact. Okay. Thank you for all the questions. I think we got through them all, and I appreciate it. And we're at the end of the time. Oh, well, round of applause. Get the applause. You got the applause on the tape? I asked Lee if he had.